I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a guest that has been a long time coming, investigative journalist Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets, a controversial book on the Bush family dynasty, and the CEO and editor-in-chief of an excellent news resource, Who, What, Why, joins us to discuss his latest piece, which actually plays off of a recent New York Times report on a plot, if you will, a campaign that involved operations against FBI agents and General H.R. McMaster by pro-Trump elements during the Trump presidency. Apparently, McMaster and these FBI agents were seen as not being loyal enough to Trump, and Russ Baker has a little bit of a different take on this story. He hones in on a character mentioned in the original New York Times piece by the name of Barbara Ledeen, and Ledeen is connected to a DC neoconservative who has a rather interesting history going back to Iran-Contra, among other things, and a collaborator and associate of Michael Flynn, the general hired by Donald Trump that caused much controversy in the news, but then was replaced by, yes, General H.R. McMaster. Russ believes that the sting operation against McMaster may contain a very interesting story involving factions of the deep state who claim to be anti-deep state fighting other factions of the deep state. And no, as usual, we are not talking about the deep state in that kind of QAnon lunatic fringe kind of way, but rather as the sort of entrenched bureaucracy within Washington, D.C. And with all that in mind, why don't we get straight to the conversation with Russ Baker of Who, What, Why. It's going to be a fascinating conversation about the plot against General H.R. McMaster during the Trump presidency. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I have been wanting to have on for some time now, a big fan of his journalistic reporting and his book, Family of Secrets, about the Bush family. He is now the CEO and editor-in-chief of Who, What, Why, Russ Baker. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I was just complaining about my picture here, but don't want to be too vain and something going wrong with the Zoom, but that's something befalling many Americans, so nothing unique to me, I guess.
So for my listeners, in case they're unfamiliar or need an introduction to Who, What, Why, maybe you could explain what this project is all about.
Sure. Well, I think a perfect example is how this week we find suddenly the media, sort of legacy media, backpedaling on this, you know, possible origins of COVID. And they're now saying, oh, maybe it was this, you know, lab. And of course, there was a long period where they were saying it couldn't possibly be the lab. And there was all this pressure and Facebook had to, you know, block any messages that said that it was the lab. And now they're saying, oh, maybe it was the lab. So, you know, this just underlines that we don't know what the truth is really about anything. And we have to be very, very careful about accepting any sort of orthodoxies, regardless of where they come from. I don't care if it's from the military or the government or the medical establishment or anything else, is that we have to be careful and we have to be open-minded. And that, to me, is the basis of good journalism. And that's really why I started Who, What, Why, because over the years, of course, I've contributed to many, many publications around the world. I found that there was a little bit of a rigidity, and I want to say a little bit of a fear of stepping outside the bounds of whatever was at the moment the acceptable narrative on anything. And I saw the consequences of this the more I went out on my own and with my book, Family of Secrets, where I discovered that how little we knew about this presidential dynasty, that much of what we thought about them was wrong, and that much of their actual story of how they came to power and what they were doing was entirely missing. And so as I began reporting on that, and that led me into a whole new understanding of major major historical traumas like Watergate and the Kennedy assassination, things I really knew nothing about beyond what pretty much anybody else knows, I thought, holy cow, there's much more work to be done. And so I decided that I would see if I could start something where the kind of honest journalism place where people could come together with an authentic appetite for truth and without any dog in the fight, without anything but a true agnosticism. And that's sort of why I started it. And I have to say, there was a lot of backlash from establishment media. And if you go online, you search for my name, there's still stuff all over the place where people call me names. And they do that. They can sort of gutlessly call people names for whatever until it turns out that maybe the person was right. Another example, and I have absolutely no position on this, was all these claims all these years that, you know, maybe there was life somewhere else in the universe. And then, you know, there were periodic reports that people had seen things, including people in the military, sightings by Air Force and other military elements. And then suddenly recently it's become this big hit, you know, with the corporate media. Now they all love this idea of UFOs. You know, I mean, oh my God, I don't even know what to say about any of this because the turnaround is so fast. It really gives you whiplash.
So real quick, just since you mentioned Family of Secrets, in case I have some younger listeners that weren't around when it initially came out, I felt like it was a very successful book. I used to see it at all the bookstores. It was on display. And of course, it dealt with the Bush family. What kind of pushback did you get for that book? And what are the main things that you think people should get out of it? If I have listeners that are younger that may want to revisit it that didn't get to read it when it first came out.
Sure. Well, I think you should know that it may have looked visible, but that was with an incredible effort and despite a lot of shutdown that went on. So, for example, I had a very good publisher, Bloomsbury, out of the UK, and they really put a lot of effort behind the book, hiring extra publicists and all sorts of things. And they had told me that they had bites from everything from the New York Times to CBS News, and everybody was fascinated with this book, and they couldn't wait to have me on. And all that turned to naught almost overnight. Suddenly, all the doors started closing, and I thought, well, what is this? All these places, people read it, and they loved the book, and suddenly, one after another, they decided not to have me on, and I thought, well, what's going on? And we never got a straight answer on this. Everybody claimed things like, oh, they forgot, or they were busy, or, I mean, really unbelievable things. Even a very famous lefty TV news show, very popular show, had me on, and I knew the host well, and they interviewed me, and they were, this is exciting, and the segment never aired. And so, you know, you have to just think, well, what the heck? But what I did understand was that there were some revelations in there concerning these major national and international historical traumas that upset or worried people somewhere at the upper echelons of these corporations. Now, how those decisions get made, I don't know. I don't know if there's a whispering campaign or what it is, but they just are not comfortable going deeper into things. And by the way, just to kind of explain how this works, because I'm far from the only journalist to experience this. Examples might be Jeffrey Epstein, you know, what was that all about? You know, and I don't know, and who does know, but I mean, his death was very, very strange, but really nobody reported anything on it other than, oh, well, they say that he killed himself. And the only one I saw that did it of the majors was 60 Minutes did a piece casting doubt on the official story, but you kind of can't go there. You know, it's like not okay until it is okay. And I think people felt that where I went with the book was somehow not okay. It was just too upsetting to people or something. But anyway, where did I go with the book? I think for younger people or anybody who doesn't know this stuff, I mean, the Bush family was unique because you had two generations of Bushes in the White House in a fairly short span of time. And not just that, but I mean, the father was an ambitious politician who went from, you know, zero to 120 in no time at all. And I get into all that in the book. I discovered why it was that he was promoted so fast. We don't have time here and I don't want to give it all away, but he basically, his family was super connected in this power structure that people call it different names, Trump and others. Well, Trump kind of destroyed the term, but academics used to call it the deep state, referring to an establishment, a kind of a consensus establishment of people who went in and out of government and big law firms and military contracts and so on. It kind of had a worldview. Maybe went to school together, were of the same economic class and so forth. And this was the milieu that the Bushes came out of and the milieu that the Bushes served. And so I think what the book is about is how little we really understand about how presidents are shaped, how they become president, who wants them to be president, why they do the things they do, and the limitations they face, plus the pressures on them to follow certain policy lines and to reward certain constituencies, which is a theme that is reflected in the article that we'll be talking about today. So that was really, I think, what Family of Secrets was about. But I did discover that my understanding of things like the John F. Kennedy assassination, I mean, I had just always assumed Lee Harvey Oswald did it because that's what all the school textbooks tell you. That's what the major historians tell you, et cetera. And I discovered, no, there was more to the story. There actually was a Bush family connection to what happened in Dallas that day, November 22, 1963. And then I looked at the Watergate scandal. And much to my astonishment, where I thought it was a cut and dried story of wrongdoing by Richard Nixon, an individual I had grown up to abhor as a young man. As I looked further into it, I realized I'm not that I would defend Nixon on many counts, but that he really was set up in this thing, that Watergate appeared to look to be a kind of a covert operation against him to push him out of office, to basically set him up. And again, I saw the footprints of the Bushes and more significantly, the footprints of the Central Intelligence Agency and other elements within the national security apparatus to which the Bush family of multiple generations was closely connected.
Now, of course, this is a good lead-in to the article, Who, What, Why Exclusive, that you co-wrote with Matt Harvey, entitled Uncovered, Is Rally Angle to White House Deep State Plot? I want to preface this to Who, What, Why, I think, is an extremely useful website, especially in this current media saturated age, because you guys will cover stuff in depth and you'll cover issues in a way that a lot of other websites don't, but you never veer into that sort of tabloid Alex Jones Drudge Report, or maybe even, you know, on the liberal side of things, maybe like a Palmer Report style of sort of tabloid journalism, but you're still talking about things like this idea of a deep state, which that sort of leads me to the title. What is this deep state plot that we're talking about involving the White House?
Right. And that's one of the other funny and kind of hypocritical things about the media, because they were ridiculing this notion, even the term deep state, because you see, this term was was legitimate, but it was ignored by the establishment. And it was used primarily by academics. The term originated overseas. It originated in Turkey, and it was a useful term from academia there as a way to understand permanently entrenched bureaucracies in the government. And so then certain people in the United States, particularly my friend Peter Dale Scott, a retired Berkeley professor, found the term useful to understand certain power dynamics. And certain people began using it. It was poo-pooed or ignored by the media, but the term was very, very useful. And then Trump came along, and he was advised by Roger Stone. Roger Stone had read a lot of these kinds of things that I and other people had done and began adopting it himself, I think for other purposes. And then he started putting a bug in Trump's ear, and he began using the term deep state to represent the people who were allied against him, this, again, permanent bureaucracy. And, you know, I think there's some truth that the establishment, much of it was allied against him, but not for the reasons he thinks, and it doesn't mean that makes him good. So this was much more complex. But anyway, although the media ridiculed the term deep state as, you know, conspiracy theory, they selectively use it. They also use terms like conspiracy or theory selectively when they want to use it. And in this case, the background of this story, if I just plunge into it, is that some years back in the early stages of the Trump administration, he had a succession of national security advisors. You may remember Michael Flynn, General Michael Flynn, who was a very controversial figure. He'd been in the Obama administration. They fired him. And then Trump brought him back. But then he had to get rid of him because of discoveries about things that Flynn had done in connection with the Soviet Union, or Russians, rather. We don't call it the Soviet Union or the Russians, as a way of sort of helping Trump's presidential campaign. So he had basically withheld information about it or lied about it to investigators. He was forced out, and they brought in this General McMaster, really kind of from the same general posture, I would say, within the military and intelligence establishment, but somewhat different on certain things. And so McMaster was brought in because it was kind of chaotic in the Trump White House. And he, at one point, was at dinner at a restaurant in Washington with a number of people. And somehow, I don't know how this happened, but he complained about Trump. And he referred to him as an idiot. And he said it was like he was like kindergarten level and how frustrating it was for him to have to work with this guy. Well, one of the people at this dinner, this woman who's CEO of Oracle, a giant tech company, she ratted him out. She went back to the White House and said, "I don't think you want a national security advisor talking that way about the president." And this story leaked a long time ago. It was reported that this had happened. In any case, for one reason or another, General McMaster resigns. I think he was forced out, but he resigns. So in 2017, when this story first emerged about McMaster bad-mouthing the president, this got back to the White House. And then whatever happened, one way or another, General McMaster suddenly was out. It was said that he resigned on his own, but the fact is that there was real pressure to get rid of him. And you flash forward 4 years, and the New York Times has this story about this deep state plot or alleged deep state plot against Trump. Basically what happened was people got in touch with the New York Times and leaked them information that the upshot of that early story about McMaster bad-mouthing Trump is that a group of people got together and decided that they were going to oust McMaster. And that's what this New York Times story that came out recently was about. It was about a quote-unquote plot to have McMaster removed. And that whole story, it's quite complicated, but in a nutshell, some people apparently decided that if they could entrap McMaster and capture him on hidden camera saying those things about Trump again, they could use that, show it to Trump, and maybe even publicize it to get McMaster forced out. So the New York Times article was basically about this plot, this group of people who was involved, an organization that does hidden camera work that someone said was involved with this. A woman who had worked for a Republican committee who was said to be have played a role in this. A billionaire head of a huge mercenary company whose brother is a was a cabinet appointee of Trump's, that he was involved, that they've been using his ranch to train operatives and how to do these kinds of covert operations. So there was a whole story about this plot. And basically what they were going to do was they were going to use a honey trap. They were going to get some very attractive women to go to this restaurant and start befriending McMaster. He used to go there regularly, and then try to lure him into a situation where he would then say bad things about Trump. That is the nutshell of what the New York Times reported. And what we did was we went into it and we found there was more to the story.
So real quick here, just so people aren't getting confused, this plot is actually carried out by people who claim, oh, we're the pro-Trump anti-deep state people. But really, it seems like they're acting as a sort of deep state themselves.
That's exactly right. That was one of the things that struck me before we began, or as we began working on our story, because something seemed strange. Something didn't really add up, because it was kind of like, wait a minute. So because you remember Trump, of course, complaining about the deep state. And then the idea was being spread that McMaster was a reflection of the deep state, which did not like Trump. But then you have this whole other group. And when you start looking at the people who were involved, you say, well, what are they? You see, and so what our article gets into is what kind of looks like people trying to call other people deep state, and really, in a sense, being very much part of a constituency, which the establishment, which you could call a deep state too.
Now, just do a little bit of a deeper dive. Out of the characters we've sort of talked about, I think the one that really comes up in this article is Barbara Ledeen. And as soon as I saw that name, I said, wait, that last name sounds familiar. Could you tell us a little bit more about Barbara Ledeen and her husband?
Well, sure. That's exactly how we began on our story. I read the New York Times piece. And by the way, you read the New York Times piece, you read our piece, they're all confusing. I mean, there's no way around it. Your show is going to be confusing to people because this is complicated stuff. And I'm sorry, but, you know, if Hollywood ends up buying the story, they'll have to knock out 90%, have a different plot line and love interest and so on. Because, you know, life is complicated. And sometimes it's hard to follow the twists and turns. But in any case, when I saw the New York Times story, and they basically just said this was a plot to remove McMaster because he was bad-mouthing Trump. That was the conclusion of the story, that they felt, this group of people felt, that this man was disloyal to Trump. But as soon as I saw the name Barbara Ledeen, and it said that she had played some sort of a role, and she said, I'm not part of a plot, but she did tell the New York Times that she had somehow facilitated a talk with somebody who had an ability to look at General McMaster's schedule or appointment book and kind of figure out the when he was likely to be going to that restaurant where they wanted to set him up. So she played some kind of a role. She said that she passed his information along to a man she thought was an operative of the group called Project Veritas, which is this conservatively affiliated organization that does these hidden camera things. They all seem to have a pattern of trying to expose liberal biases and things like that.
I was going to add real quick, not to interrupt you, but Project Veritas, they claim to be, you know, oh, we're just getting the truth out there, but they edit a lot of their footage. They've gone after Planned Parenthood, Acorn, all these other different groups, but they play around with the facts more than people realize, I think.
You know, they insist they don't, but I think everybody can judge for themselves by watching these things. I mean, if the purpose of a video is to catch one person expressing views that supposedly they shouldn't really hold, of course that's selective. But in any case, so that was the sort of original plot. But then when I read the Times piece and I was reading Barbara Ledeen's name, like you, I said, Ledeen, boy, that name is really familiar. Isn't that a name from Iran-Contra, the Iran-Contra scandal, one of the great scandals American 20th century history. And again, for your younger viewers, I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail, but basically it was an illegal operation by elements within the U.S. government during the Reagan-Bush presidency to do a bunch of things they weren't supposed to do. Too complicated to explain here, but it involved getting around congressional prohibitions of the U.S. getting involved in a war in Central America and using U.S. resources to support one side. It also involved a larger plot, which was an attempt to make sure that Reagan and Bush won the presidency and that the man before them, Jimmy Carter, lost by mucking him up with the hostages. There were American hostages being held in Iran. It's a very complicated, sprawling story. No way to resolve it here. But in any case, Michael Ledeen was involved with lots of these things. And then as I started reviewing Michael Ledeen, I said, well, wait a minute, Michael Ledeen shows up in more of these things than I've ever seen with almost anyone. Scandal after scandal. I mean, flash forward many years after the Iran-Contra, we had two Iraq wars. He shows up in these. And with the second Iraq war with Bush Jr., you may have heard of the term weapons of mass destruction. They basically created a fake justification to have a war, which resulted in the deaths of enormous numbers of innocent people. And that was a group of people who were pushing this line and basically falsifying evidence, trying to set up the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. And Michael Ledeen was involved with that again. And he shows up time and time and time again. And so I thought, well, this guy is part of this group they call the neocons. And I'll pause here because I'm sure you have some things to say about that.
Well, I was going to say there was even a 1987 Washington Report piece entitled Michael Ledeen, Man of Mystery. So he's definitely had his fingers in a lot of pies, we'll put it that way. But I did want to get into this issue of the neocons. When we talk about the neocons, I think we mainly think of these sort of think tanks like the Project for a New American Century and the sort of nucleus around the W. Bush administration, the Dick Cheneys, John Boltons, and Douglas Fifes of the world, who were really the architects of the Iraq War, correct?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think to sort of define neoconservatives versus conservatives, one of the I think differences would be the enthusiasm for unfettered empire building. A lot of conservatives, if you look at the sort of Ron Pauls of the world, Rand Pauls and so on, they're very skeptical. If you go all the way back, Senator Bob Taft, they were largely isolationists. They didn't want the U.S. Going around the world, getting involved everywhere. They thought, well, among other things, they were fiscal conservatives, and they didn't want a huge U.S. government budget. And of course, with a giant military and operations all over the world, it's very expensive results and taxation and so forth. And so they would tend to be more selective about supporting conflicts. Whereas the neocons took more of an approach that some liberals shared, albeit supposedly for different reasons, which was that the U.S. had a role all over the world, whether it was allegedly advancing the values of freedom, or it was protecting and expanding American markets and sources of raw materials. In other words, the typical reason for empire. And so the neocons were quite unabashed in their enthusiasm. They almost never saw a war they didn't like, and they just couldn't wait to have war after war after war. But I think one of the defining characteristics of the neocons was their alarm over fundamental Islam and their staunch loyalty to Israel and to protecting Israel, irrespective, it seems, of any of the particulars of the situation. And so they were very, very enthusiastic and prime supporters, making it possible for people like Benjamin Netanyahu even to get in power in the first place and to stay in power, come back to power, that kind of thing. And these were largely neocons of many different stripes. Some of them were prominent American Jews, but others were non-Jewish, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and so forth. So it was a mixed cast of people, but they I have always argued that Israel is, they'd like to say if Israel didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. So they see it as a good investment and a primary a defender of U.S. interests in this critical oil-bearing region.
So in terms of how this connects to Israel, I don't want people to get the wrong impression. I don't think we're talking about some protocols of Zion, you know, anti-Semitic stuff here. So what do we mean when we say that there's an Israeli aspect to this plot?
And I want to say something about that. I don't know why the New York Times didn't get into who the Ladines are and what they do. It may simply be they didn't quite connect the dots, give them the benefit of that. It may have been that it's an uncomfortable subject. And I want to be the first to say that this is hard terrain to get into. You know, any story that you do that deals with foreign countries, you know, I don't care if it's Israel and the challenges that American Jews face, or it was Northern Ireland and the challenges that Americans of Irish background face. We all have interests in other countries where our forebears came from and so on. You know, and these things come into play in various ways. And we have to be able to talk honestly about policy without in any way demonizing ethnic, religious, racial groups. We have to find a way to talk about these things. It's very, very difficult. Very difficult. And the second you do, people attack you. But the problem is if we're all silenced from it, being able to have these conversations. And I want to point out how many American Jews are opposed to the Netanyahu regime and its policies and don't like these neocons and think that they are not serving the interests of either the United States or humanity. So it's very, very important to understand there also historically have been people in Israel who were troubled and wanted to find a way to move forward with a two-state solution or some other solution. So these are complicated issues, and we have to just be careful that we don't get off track into areas where we're no longer focused on the facts of the case. And so the facts of the case are very simple, that these neocons who are Americans for a variety of reasons, they all have different reasons, they support this particular policy, and they show up in this constellation of people who wanted to get rid of General McMaster out of Trump's administration. And what we show in our article at Who What Why is that one of the main reasons that the Ladines and their circle didn't like McMaster was not just that he said something about Trump, but that he was much more, let's say, cautious and much more, I think, making much more of an effort to find a proper American stance toward the situation with Israel and the Palestinians than that which some of the other folks were advocating. And that, I think, is the core story that has not been told as to the pressures that were being applied to Donald Trump. And we have to remember something. Donald Trump was the most gung-ho American president ever in support of the most extreme Likud coalition policies in Israel that have been harshly condemned by so many different people in Israel and everywhere else. Trump was an unabashed supporter. He was even trying to outdo Netanyahu himself on some fronts. And as you know, he moved the U.S. embassy. He did practically everything he could to be totally one-sided. And so he really was unabashed. But the idea that someone like McMaster had to be forced out, I think there was concern that maybe in some way he was going to temper or modify Trump's own policies.
I was going to add to that. I mean, when we examine Ladine a bit closer, Michael Ladine, I mean, he was quoted in an article for Breitbart, as you point out in your own article, where basically there's this sense among some within this sort of milieu that, you know, McMaster is too hostile to Trump and not really pro-Israel enough, or that he's watering down critiques of, you know, the quote unquote Islamic world. That seems to be where Ledeen takes the most issue with McMaster.
That's right. And we have evidence of that with Barbara Ledeen posting screeds on Facebook and so forth and commenting about him. They were very clear about their animus to McMaster and their sense that he was insufficiently in, let's say, the Netanyahu corner. And this is very, very important because we have to remember that the United States provides billions of dollars of aid a year to Israel. There are questions as to whether Netanyahu and his regime would even be in power without this kind of support. Understanding the ability of a group of just really private individuals to influence what the President of the United States does, this affects the whole world. And we have to keep in mind that right now, sentiment is shifting in the world, particularly because of what people see as the excesses coming out of the settler movement in Israel, where people are, we see this right on camera, where people just literally go in and occupy somebody else's house and say, "Tough beans, I'm here, you're not. I have your house now." I don't think it's very, very hard to defend that, but they do. And so the ability to do these kinds of things, which are very, very counterproductive to peace and to different peoples getting along, it's also very counterproductive to the U.S.'s own image in the world because we seem to be supporting that. And of course, it causes endless political strife and divides Americans. And so this is really what this story is about. It's about a small group of people utilizing spy tactics, and they hired a retired a British spy. They used these ranches to train. I mean, this is pretty big stuff. And it's all for the purpose, it seems, of pressuring the President of the United States and making sure that he stays on that very aggressive policy track in the Middle East.
I just wanted to add a few more things to that before we close out. First, I mean, we also have to consider people like the late now, Sheldon Adelson, and how much they back Trump financially. And I think just more generally, we have to remember these sort of pro-Likud, pro-Netanyahu neocons. I mean, they're not even happy with liberal Zionists. I mean, they, as you point out in the article, they even criticized people like the Clintons in the sense that they were apparently too critical of Israel. I think these same people also criticized Obama for not being sufficiently pro-Israel in their eyes. And when you really look at it, I don't think the Clintons or Obama were particularly harsh on Israel, but these same sort of hard right neocon elements seem to take an extreme view where, you know, if you criticize Israel at all, it's the end of the world.
Absolutely. And let's keep in mind that people like Adelson, who passed away not long ago, billionaire, has a lot of money. Does he represent who? I mean, he doesn't live in Israel, but these people have the ability. They fund settler movements. They fund the building of religious institutions over there. And then they live in the United States. I mean, a lot of these people even had non-Jewish wives, and yet they're funding these Orthodox institutions that would look down upon that. So you do have to ask what in the world their agenda is. And I want to emphasize, I'm here in New York, and we have a large Jewish community here that's very, very upset. And I want to be clear, it has strong humanitarian orientation and tendencies. I have been fighting for years with this group. So it is so important to note that a deep discomfiture with the ability of a small number of people like Adelson and the Ledeens and so on to shape a very aggressive policy that they don't have to live with. I know plenty of Israelis that, have very mixed feelings. I mean, they're living there. They are experiencing, rocket attacks themselves. And I'm not trying to equate anything, but I mean, they don't want to have a situation like that either. I think plenty of them understand that their situation is more precarious and is worse in so many respects because of the kind of things that American neocons themselves do. And this plot is, I think, probably the latest example of that.
And I just wanted to add, so I think a lot of people respond by saying, well, Barbara Ladin says, I am not part of a plot. What would your response be to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because as a journalist, when I interview people and I ask them questions, the way they answer, you have to understand that some of it is legalism. So when you say, I am not part of a plot, I mean, that's present tense. You know, the plot is already over. So the question might be, you know, did she say, I was not part of a plot, or, you know, I've never been part of a plot, or I don't consider that to be a plot, you see? So these kind of statements are subject to interpretation.
In closing, and I also wanted to note this, I also thought it was telling that her animus towards H.R. McMaster is very well documented. And I think you even note that she wrote at one point, we owe a lot to Eric Prince of Blackwater fame. So I guess the plot thickens. Is there anything that you really want my listeners to get out of this article? What is the one thing you think they should understand?
Sure, it's so complicated. You know, before I came on here, I reread my own article. My head was spinning, so I understand how hard it is to follow this stuff. I think the bottom line is that in a democracy, the people need information and they need transparency. We need to know why decisions are made. And we need to understand if undue influence is being applied. This, of course, is a problem in every aspect of society, whether it's the role of lobbyists or the revolving door where people go in and out of government. They go from the military to companies that benefit from contracts. It's all of a piece. And understanding this is critical. It's our job as journalists is to try to understand it and then share what we figured out with the people so they can make their own decisions. All you get from shining light on these things is a better world. And so that's really, I think, what this comes down to, understanding that these kinds of machinations are not in the past, that they're always going on, and that we have to remain extremely vigilant, and we have to care, and we have to pay attention to the details and figure out why things are happening.
I also wanted to get one more thing out of you before I let you go, and I appreciate your being so generous with your time. Another aspect of this story seems to be that Michael Flynn was fired as chief of the Defense Intelligence Agency by Barack Obama, right? And he didn't last through the whole Trump administration either. And of course, the Ladins are very close and have collaborated with Flynn. Could that maybe play a role in all of this? Because of course, McMaster was Flynn's successor. So maybe this was a little bit of revenge.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Michael Ladin and Flynn wrote a book together. I mean, they're joined at the hip. I don't think you can see this without seeing it as a, you know, they use the term plot. I mean, I don't love the word plot, but I mean, I guess that's what it is if you look at the dictionary definition. And, you know, these are factions. And by the way, I mean, it's very interesting to see that McMaster and Ladin have been involved in the same defense think tank themselves. So, you know, some of this stuff is like an argument on a head of a pin. It's not like McMaster is anti-Israel. He was just trying to modify a little bit some of the statements coming out of the White House. He was just trying to kind of steer a course where there was a little bit of possibility of some sort of success. So it's very important to understand this, that when you talk about that term deep state, I mean, if anything, you're looking at one deep state against another, and that, you know, with any of these groups, with any of these people, it's you're not getting a wide divergence of opinion. And of course, this is one of the main problems I think that America faces, that we don't hear that individuals like a Bernie Sanders are considered to be wildly beyond the pale But in European terms, a Bernie Sanders in his positions, he would probably be the equivalent of a sort of a liberal Republican, you know? So I think that's just so important. And that comes out of this as well, is that American policy is so narrow. The possibilities of what can be achieved are so narrow that people of one position can put a huge effort into toppling a person who's not really so very different from themselves.
And I was going to say, I did not realize until reading this Who Will Why exclusive that Michael and Barbara will apparently not be the last of the Ledeens in DC. I guess their daughter, Simone Ledeen, is also very involved with Middle East policy.
Isn't that unbelievable? I mean, I was shocked to discover that their daughter was, I believe it, it's Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East policy. I mean, Trump put her in. So, I mean, he kind of like handed, you could almost say he handed all the Middle East policy over to this group of, you know, four or five people, General Flynn and his buddies, you know? I mean, just a small group of people, and they turned the entire U.S. policy about the Middle East basically over to them.
And I was just going to, the reason I mentioned that is because I think a lot of people look at the Trump presidency and say, oh, he wasn't like the neocons, or the neocons didn't like him, because they'll look at the Bulwark and some of these neocons that were very much part of the Never Trumper movement. But then on the other hand, you have these neocons like Ledeen, and even, you know, John Bolton ended up around Trump for a while. There was division among the neocons about whether or not to support Trump, and they were involved with the administration.
Right. And I think this reveals the fact that we're all complex beings and we don't all share the exact same constellation of views. And that, I think that a lot of those folks, the Bushes, who I've written about in my book, Family of Secrets, a lot of them turned away from Trump because they felt that his tendencies and his personality and his behavior were disruptive to the established order. So, but I don't know that they necessarily disagree with all of his policies, but there are definitely bifurcations. And, you know, the Bush way of supporting Israel and handling the Middle East is a little different. The Bushes were also were great friends with many of these other regimes in the Middle East. And, you know, there was the whole thing of the Arabists in the State Department. So, again, very, very complicated, working both sides of the street, so-called. This also reminds us how little we understand about most things and how much work we all have to do to educate ourselves. I mean, we really need to read books, and we need to read books that aren't necessarily, on the New York Times bestseller list or approved by the establishment. We need to go out of our way to look for voices and viewpoints that we might not otherwise hear. And I would commend you and what you're doing in your program, because you are doing exactly that. You're providing Americans, and I believe a new generation, with an opportunity to get themselves educated and to really empower themselves to play a more useful role in setting a better course for America and for humanity.
Well, I want to thank you, Russ Baker, for joining us and for those very, very kind comments. How can my listeners keep up with your work and the work of other writers at the great Who, What, Why website?
Sure. So our organization is called Who, What, Why, and the website is whowhatwhy.org. And that signifies that we're a nonprofit organization. We take no advertising. All of our funding comes from the public, which allows us to just do stories and dig in and find out what's going on and say it with neither fear nor favor. My last book is called Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years, a long subtitle. Just remember, Family of Secrets. It's available. And I think it tells some of this story. My next book, I hope, be out next few years. But thank you so much for having me on.
By the way, with Family of Secrets, I think Gore Vidal even gave it a two thumbs up.
I was very pleased that Gore Vidal said some kind things about it. Yes, I really appreciated that. He was a man who went his own way and had a thoughtful and unique analysis of so many things.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Russ Baker. keep up with the work he and others are doing at the excellent website whowhatwhy.org. You will not be disappointed. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Brian, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.